This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
Find out how a black dwarf star can explode even without a fuel source.
Just because interesting things become very, very rare doesn't mean that they have entirely stopped.
ISU astrophysicist Matt Kaplan says maybe what happens once all the stars have burned out quadrillions of years from now won't be cold, dead, and silent. Plus, close to 300 ISU students have tested positive for the coronavirus after a little more than a week of classes. ISU President Larry Dietz tells you how he'll decide whether to close the campus. Some students remain in normal even though all their classes are online. Hear why. And an ISU biomathematician says being right about his projections of infection rates is bittersweet. All that and a news update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on WGLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from WGLT listeners. Join the community of informed news consumers who listen to WGLT and also support it financially. Learn more about how you can support WGLT's nonprofit public service mission at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Let's run down some of the day's top stories. McLean County announced a record 99 new COVID-19 cases today. Young adults account for a vast majority of those. The county's total of more than 1,100 confirmed COVID cases has doubled in less than 3 weeks. U.S. Senator Tammy Duckworth says she and other Democrats want to get federal COVID-19 relief to state and local governments as soon as possible. Ultimately, she says it hinges on majority Republicans agreeing. Duckworth says Democrats proposed $150 billion in federal assistance for governments struggling with declining tax revenues during the pandemic. Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell does not support that package, but Duckworth says she sees some hope.
I do think the White House is, Mark Meadows, is agreeable to putting some money in there for state and local governments, but we can't seem to get to a final agreement yet. That's why we're still negotiating even today.
Duckworth met virtually today with Peoria's mayor, State Farm, and the Danville VA director to talk about COVID-19's local impact and what federal help they need. Illinois was among the states helping renominate President Trump today as the Republican Party nominee. Tim Schneider, the Illinois Republican Party chairman, represented the state in the state's roll call.
Home of the first Republican president of the United States, Abraham Lincoln, and the birthplace of Ronald Reagan. I proudly cast 67 votes for our president and the next president of the United States, Donald J. Trump.
Schneider made his announcement through a video link, though he was one of a handful of top Illinois GOP leaders who made the trip to Charlotte for the event. Former Peoria Republican Congressman Ray LaHood and U.S. Transportation Secretary confirmed today he's endorsing Democratic nominee Joe Biden in November's presidential election. LaHood served as U.S. Secretary of Transportation under President Obama. He says he and former Vice President Biden developed a lasting friendship in that time.
I admire his leadership. I admire his years of public service, and I admire the fact that he's put out a very strong agenda.
LaHood says Biden has a better plan to address the COVID-19 pandemic and its economic impact. LaHood's son, Peoria Congressman Darren LaHood, is one of the Illinois delegates for President Donald Trump at this week's GOP convention. This is Sound Ideas on 89.1 FM, WGLT, and WGLT.org. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
Illinois State University has already seen 273 students test positive for COVID-19. There were just 70 cases as of Friday, meaning the number of COVID-positive students tripled in just 3 days. An ISU spokesperson says about 1,500 tests have been administered on campus since the first day of classes, August 17th. ISU President Larry Dietz joins us to talk about that issue. Thanks for speaking with us.
Always a pleasure, Charlie.
What metrics will you use to decide whether to close the campus?
Well, we're monitoring that literally on a daily basis, and so we don't have a number per se. I think a lot of it will have to do with how many folks have tested positive, and it'll have to do with isolation capacity. Will have to do with how many folks are hospitalized, and thankfully at this point we don't. I'm not aware of any. It's a moving target and a complex issue that. That we're monitoring, so I don't have any specific, date or time. I do know that, we obviously are only in our second week of classes here, and so as individuals coming back to the campus, we're not sure how many came in who might have been asymptomatic, but could have, been carrying the virus. We're not sure how many students attended. How many parties? That first weekend, we were aware of a couple of very large parties, but I think this last weekend that was curtailed considerably. And so, we're going to continue to educate students about the importance of wearing face coverings and washing their hands and avoiding large gatherings of people. And we're hoping for the best, but we're not naive. We knew that these numbers would go up, and so we're monitoring it really daily.
Of those 273, how many are on-campus students living in residence halls?
Yeah, I'm not sure of that. I can tell you that we have 24 in isolation that are positive right now. I don't know how many of those individuals are on versus off campus. Our testing also, we're only looking at the students that we've tested. Some may have gone out to the Interstate Center and gotten tested in other places, but our numbers are only for students and only the ones that we've tested at two sites, and we just started that testing a week ago today.
If 24 are in isolation, how much isolation space do you have?
We have units that are spread throughout the housing system. The total number of beds I'm not sure of right now, but we're not anywhere close to capacity. I was told this afternoon by our planning group.
The FDA last week approved the saliva test developed at the U of I for broader use. That's something ISU has been watching and had hoped to use. What now?
Well, we're in constant communication with them, as are the other public universities in the state. The issue is the capacity to roll that out to us quickly is somewhat limited because of the demand that they have. So we've been told that we would be able to work with them, but probably not for another at least 6 and possibly 12 weeks. So we would be delighted to have their tests here. We are anxious to use those, and we're working toward that end.
Would you use U of I-based labs, or would you develop your own lab capacity somewhere, since the U of I is making it open source?
That's something that we're talking back and forth. Our staff are talking to their staff about this. There are pros and cons to both. We have the capabilities to have the labs here. So I think that probably would be our preference. But again, that's we're anxious to do business however we can do business to make sure that it's a quality test that we're implementing here in the best way that will benefit our students.
So in 6 to 12 weeks, when it's ripe and ready, how much will you test and how often?
Again, kind of open to discussion on that. The good news is that the cost of the test would be reduced dramatically, and that's another figure that's we're still negotiating with them on, but it won't be anywhere near the price that we're paying right now. So the potential to offer more frequent testing is there, and we would like to follow that.
Illinois State University President Larry Dietz, thanks so much.
Thank you. Appreciate the time.
I'm Charlie Schlenker.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Most classes at Illinois State University have moved online. A lot of students have come to normal anyway. WGLT student reporter Katrina Peterson tells you why.
Over 70% of ISU's undergraduate students are taking all of their classes online this fall. yet college students still fill the dorms and off-campus apartments. ISU freshman Rebecca Slochuk says she feels physically coming to campus is the only way she can stay ahead.
I didn't plan Corona, like obviously, like I didn't want this to happen, and like it's not our fault that Corona happened. I wanted to come just to get like the social aspect, just to try to be here, see what it's all about, and because it still is like our freshman year, we should try to make the most of it for our freshman year for sure. At least start with the transition as much as we can.
Slochuk says her sister is an ISU alum who influenced her decision to come to campus. Slochuk says her sister made her want to move forward despite the setbacks that came with COVID-19.
I am only a freshman. I should like experience like an RA, like the dining halls, all of that, and just like being on campus. Because if I stayed home, I definitely would have been like a step behind. And so now I feel like I'm like here, and so I'm at least in the college aspect of life.
Slochuk may be here to stay ahead and to stay socially active, but ISU track and field student athlete Rachel Hickey says her sport has rules which help her to get the experience she is paying for at ISU.
We still have 8-hour practice weeks, official 8-hour practice weeks right now, versus our normal 20 that we would have when we'd actually be in season. So regardless of the cancellation of the season, we do still have required practices and different regulations and guidelines you have to follow in order to be able to practice on campus.
ISU track student athletes are only running two at a time and are wearing masks at practice. Hickey says she believes she and her teammates are doing their part, and she hopes to continue practicing.
Student athletes would like to compete at some point, and we're doing our part, and we're wearing our masks, and we're trying to stay socially distant. So we'd love to see more ISU students wearing the mask. I want my full college experience, but mine looks a lot different than the normal person. But in order for all of us to return to that type of experience, we all have to make some sacrifices right now.
Other ISU students have returned to normal simply because they are stuck in their leases at off-campus apartments. Mary Closer signed her lease last autumn, expecting a seamless transition to this fall. Then came the pandemic, and now Closer can't get out of a commitment at College Place Uptown.
So I was stuck in this contract, obviously. So I decided to come down because some of my classes were going to be in person, but they got changed the day before school started. So yeah, I'm stuck with this lease.
For those living on campus, ISU extended contract cancellation dates when more classes moved online. Closer says the lease and the classes required to continue on her career path create an obligation for her to stay in normal.
If I wasn't a junior, I would have probably stayed at home and took classes through a community college because there's no reason to be paying what I pay to go here to take online classes. But unfortunately, since I'm in my major classes, the community colleges around me don't offer the classes I need to graduate on time. So that's why I'm still here.
The McLean County Health Department has reported hundreds of new cases of COVID-19 in the last several weeks, most of them among people in their late teens or 20s. Closer says she is beginning to think the lease isn't enough to keep her in normal.
And if everything does close down, I personally wouldn't stay here because that would mean the fitness center is gone. The dining center would probably be closed. I would feel like really isolated here since I wouldn't really want to cook down here in a tiny apartment. I'd rather be at home with my family and my pets and be able to like see some of my high school friends.
Closer says she knows university leaders want to be careful. She says she feels limited on campus. She says she's disappointed in the standards of the students who party. All these pressures combine, Closer says, to make her feel in the middle of nowhere. For WGLT, I'm Katrina Peterson.
You can see interactive graphics showing daily case totals and the county's testing positivity rate at WGLT.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Back in May, WGLT interviewed an Illinois State University biomathematician, L.J. Ockman, about what his model projected for COVID-19's U.S. death toll by mid-August. Ockman says it would be at least 170,000 deaths. Here we are in mid-August. That was exactly right. Ockman tells Ryan Denham it's bittersweet for his model to bear out with such accuracy.
On one hand, as a scientist, it feels good to know that the methods we are employing are proven to be meaningful. And then on the other hand, as a citizen, watching think the price we are paying as a result of the ignorance displayed towards the science-based recommendations makes me really feel sad.
So aside from your model, generally speaking, how have the most commonly cited models performed up to this point? How reliable have their projections been?
Yeah, I think I need to emphasize that models are not magic. So they are as good as what goes into them. When scientifically solid modeling approaches and correct assumptions are employed with good data, the resulting predictions are bound to be accurate. During my interview with you in April, as you also pointed out at the time, that the CDC estimate for mid-August was around 147,000 versus my forecast of 170,000, which turned out to be more accurate. The CDC analysis was based on old data that failed to account for the effects of opening up without the infrastructure for contact tracing, testing of asymptomatic individuals. I guess it also suffered from a flaw common to all models based solely on statistics, which is an underestimation of the number of asymptomatic carriers. Statisticians are very careful with things they can measure, but careless about things they cannot measure. That bias has led statisticians to an incorrect estimate of the basic reproductive number.
What does your model suggest about the death tolls coming this fall? If you can look ahead to October, November.
Right.
What are you seeing there?
Yeah. So regarding the death toll for this coming fall, we are now in a little bit different place than we were in March. Now we know more about the dynamics of the disease. We understand the infectiousness of the virus better. We have obviously more data about the virus public behavior and virus public interactions. And healthcare providers are getting better at treatment options. Now we have new medicines that are being tried. I read that the healthcare professionals now are getting better even using the ventilators on patients. So as a result, all model forecasts seem to be converging towards a similar numbers now, and which is around 250,000 by mid-October, and that's consistent with my model's predictions as well.
What is the, if we don't want to see 250,000 deaths by mid-October, what are the levers that we could pull to make that happen?
Oh, this one is easy. First and foremost is the testing and contact tracing. That's how South Korea, who had the first infection back in January, the same day as our first infection, and their death toll is minuscule compared to ours, because they had an extensive and sophisticated testing and contact tracing policies in place. Vigilant social distancing is the lever that I would still strongly pull. And of course, the upcoming and hopefully extensive vaccination program. One of the concepts that COVID has introduced to our daily conversations is herd immunity. But we need to remember that herd immunity is achieved through vaccination.
Yeah, so herd immunity is not just a product of, you know, look at a place like New York, just having a bunch of people get it and survive it is not what herd immunity is what you're
right, saying. Right. After all, with vaccinations, we are really infecting people, but we are infecting in a controlled sense. And we have a very good working example of how not to do the herd immunity. That's Sweden, right? They tried this model and that toll turn out to be higher than their neighboring countries.
That's ISU Professor Aljay Ackman speaking with Ryan Denham about his COVID-19 modeling. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. You're listening to 89.1 FM, WGLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media. Most physicists believe after stars burn out, it's all over. Cold, silent, dead, boring, all that. But new theoretical work from Illinois State University astrophysicist Matt Kaplan hints maybe not. Kaplan tells Dana Vollmer there can be cosmic fireworks as stellar remnants known as black dwarfs explode in supernova. Kaplan tells us when the last hurrah will come.
Never, and relatively soon compared to eternity, depending how you look at it. You know, as best we can tell, the universe is going to be around forever, and it's just going to expand and cool, and eventually all the interesting things will stop, and it'll reach this state that we call heat death, where nothing interesting ever happens again anywhere ever.
Can you explain a little bit more about heat death?
You know, stars are burning. They are powered by nuclear fusion in their core, so eventually stars will run out of fuel. Galaxies will disperse, you know, little interactions will end up flinging stars out eventually, and galaxies will very slowly evaporate over trillions of years. And so eventually, in maybe 100 to, you know, more than that, trillions of years, which is many, you know, hundreds of times the current age of the universe, you know, the processes that we see happening today will cease. And the universe will be entering this sort of heat death very gradually, where eventually, you know, it gets dark, it gets cold, there's no more life, and entropy is sort of maximized. That's what we mean when we say heat death.
And so it sounds like in your work, you've kind of calculated a slightly different vision of what the end of the universe will look like compared to what we classically think about.
Just because interesting things become very, very rare doesn't mean that they have entirely stopped. So there might still be interesting things happening in the universe, even out to 10 to the 1100 years, which is a number so big that if you wrote it out, it would take up like most of a paragraph. This number is significantly larger than any other number you will ever consider in your life if you are even like a professional physicist. The basic idea is that, yeah, heat death is still going to happen, but there is this very interesting window of opportunity that opens up in about 10 to the 1100 years, where massive black dwarf stars, which are going to be these cold, dead remnants of stars today, might start spontaneously exploding in supernova. So, you know, a star like our sun is not going to explode. It doesn't have enough mass to eventually explode in a supernova. That is a fate that is reserved for stars more than about 10 times the mass of the sun. Stars like our sun, they're going to burn the hydrogen in their core into helium. And as they come to exhaust that fuel, the core is going to contract. The outer layers are going to sort of puff up and be shed off after a giant phase. And what you're going to be left with is something that's about half the mass of the sun, contracted into something about the size of the Earth, which is no longer undergoing any nuclear fusion. And so that's a white dwarf. That is this white-hot exposed core of a star. But white dwarfs, they don't have a heat source anymore. They are sort of like a pan that has been heated up on the stove that you've then taken off of the burner. So all it can do is just give off the leftover heat from when it was still an active living star. And it will have turned black because it's not shining anymore. If you wait long enough, 99% of the stars in our universe, the ones that don't explode in supernova, will have cooled off to become white dwarfs that then become black dwarfs.
Those black dwarfs will then also eventually supernova, right?
That's the new thing. So that is the new result, which is that the most massive black dwarfs actually can explode if you wait long enough. Nuclear reactions happening in our sun are thermonuclear, which means that the core of the sun is hot enough that it can actually smash protons together to make heavier elements. And this releases energy and makes the star shine. This is very difficult and requires temperatures of 1,000,000 degrees because there's a very strong electric repulsion between nuclei. You know, they're both positively charged, so they repel. So in a black dwarf, there isn't thermal energy to bring nuclei very close together to get them to fuse. But quantum mechanically, there can be this non-zero probability that they can still spontaneously fuse. It's called quantum tunneling. Through quantum tunneling, nuclei can basically spontaneously pass through the barrier and fuse as if there was, you know, no barrier to begin with, if you wait long enough. The probability is very, very low for these reactions to happen, but they are not sort of forbidden, so they can still happen if you wait long enough. What you're going to find is that a star, a white dwarf today that was made of carbon, oxygen, neon, these very light elements, will have, through quantum tunneling, produced a large amount of iron. this is significant because it means that the star is losing the ability to support itself against gravity. Iron is less capable of propping up a star than carbon, oxygen, and neon because it has fewer protons and fewer electrons to sort of provide resistance against gravity. So eventually, once enough iron has been produced through these quantum tunneling reactions, the star can be above its own mass limit or threshold for collapse, and it can undergo this very quick and rapid gravitational collapse, which is the trigger for a supernova.
And so what theoretically happens after that last black dwarf supernova?
If some other exotic process can make some explosion somewhere happen, maybe it could. But as far as I can tell, I would be happy to call that heat death, where everything is cold and dark and black and uninteresting forever.
Illinois State University astrophysicist Matt Kaplan says everything he put in his paper relies on physics today. Calculations about the expansion of the universe, nuclear reactions, and what's currently known about particles and stars. New discoveries could change that forecast for the end of the universe, because the timescale is quadrillions of years long. Kaplan spoke with Dana Vollmer. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories, which today came from Ryan Denham, Dana Vollmer, and student reporter Katrina Peterson. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is 89.1 FM WGLT and WGLT.org.